The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Hi, I'm Ed Tedemer. I'm a fat and happy member of the George S. Pepper Society here at the Free Library of Fabulous and Amazing Phenomena. Who else is a Pepper Society? I bet all these people in the front, right? If you're a Pepper member, you get like to go up on the top of the roof and have some swell finger food and meet the author. It's pretty groovy. It's an elite thing. I urge you to join us and sit down front. It's great to see a full house here at the Parkway Central on the first night of what looks to be a brutal winter. Greetings especially to our overflow crowd watching on the big screen above us. If you're up there, let us hear it by banging on the floor. Yes, yes. Thank you. We'll all be up there later with you when the great Calvin Trillin will sit and sign some books for us all. Okay, before we begin, it's time to do the customary silencing of the cell phones. And I suggest that you pull yours out and tweet or text a friend, "I'm taking your picture," and posting it immediately on Twitter. And let them know you're here, having a great time at the Parkway Central. They will be green with envy. Send. Ho-ho! Resizing, uploading, and you're on. This evening's author shindig is made possible by the Free Library of Philadelphia Foundation and through the support of private philanthropy. The Free Library Foundation enriches the library's essential services and quality programs. To learn more about the foundation and perhaps share a little of your own personal private philanthropy, please visit freelibrary.org/support. Or feel free to slip me a fat check later in the evening, and I'll make sure it gets to the appropriate people. Tonight, I have been given the extraordinary honor to introduce to you Calvin Trillin, humorous food writer, best-selling author. Mr. Trillin is a longtime New Yorker staff writer and deadline poet for The Nation. He has also written for The New York Times, NPR, Time Magazine, yada, yada. You know his work, I bet, or you wouldn't be here. His tongue-in-cheek articles have been syndicated to newspapers across the country and collected along with his satirical poems in books like Uncivil Liberties, If You Can't Say Something Nice, and A Heck of a Job. And his collection of true crime reporting called Killings is a personal fave that I love to surprise people with. Now, I just want to let you know that I talked with our friend Jen Weiner earlier today about how excited I was to be able to be here tonight, and she suggested that I bring some food to Mr. Trillin and write him a little political poem. The pretzel egg sandwich didn't make it past 10 a.m. from the market. So if I may digress, a little pathetic limerick. A word of caution for President Obama, no matter that you got Osama, because on election day, as always here in PA, it's Philly, Pittsburgh, and in between Alabama. Okay. Thank you. Mr. Trillin joins us to discuss his 27th published book, which is called Quite Enough of Calvin Trillin, 40 Years of Funny Stuff. This compilation of hand-picked works stretches across Calvin Trillin's great career and is based on subjects that vary from economics to personal family memories, each infused with his signature brand of humor. I just want to let you know that my personal memory of Mr. Trillin, I first really became fully aware of how Calvin Trillin could irrevocably transform someone's life. It was in 1982 when I read his profile of The Beer Drinker's Guide to Reading, Pennsylvania, the birthplace of my dear mother. This guide was written by Suds Krogh and Dregs Donegan. And Mr. Trillin was kind enough to publicize their drinking guide and document his own tour of Reading's funkier drinking establishments in the New Yorker magazine. With the New Yorker in one hand and a copy of Suds and Dregs, now rare and no doubt priceless guidebook in the other. Siobhan, do you have that up there in the rare book department, I hope? My new bride and her brother and I traveled to Reading to enjoy the Yuengling's Premium at Jimmy's Peanut Bar, where one crunches across the shell-laden floor, the Black and Tans at the Showboat, where every inch of wall space is claimed by all manner of quality taxidermy, and Appeals served with a 25-cent shot of unnamed whiskey at my favorite, Stanley's Bar. Stanley's was old-fashioned. It had a separate side room for what it quaintly called the Little Ladies, where I instructed my new bride to wait until her brother and I drank our fill. Stanley's bar could accommodate about 15 men standing, no stools, and had a little trough running along the bottom, which allowed one to keep one's place at the bar, even when nature might call in a certain way. Around the bar, one could purchase, and I quote Mr. Trillin's New Yorker piece, an inventory of goods comparable to a small Kmart. Naturally, Stanley's has takeout and six-packs and lighter fluid and potato chips and work gloves and lottery tickets and kerosene space heaters and gas Teflon appliance connectors for sale for about $5. Well, the brother-in-law and I were admiring a set of jumper cables on display just above the Rock and Rye when my wife peeked into the bar from the Little Lady's side dining room and was immediately rebuffed by a haunting chorus of boos from Stanley's other gentlemen customers that made disgusted Eagles fans sound like kindergartners. I believe I made the mistake of joining the chorus for a split second, and we made the drive home from Reading in deafening silence. Calvin Trillin introduced me, and probably you, to great barbecue in Kansas City, inspired us to hunt for magical Boudin sausage throughout Louisiana, a lot of good road trips there, incomparable kitchen sink omelets at Chopson's Grocery in New York, and he's recently taunted me with the shrimp at Mosca's outside New Orleans, which I plan to get to before year's end. He has taught me about the absolute treasure that can be found in a good free street parking space, and most important, through sharing his life with his beloved Alice, he taught me the utter importance of treasuring your bride, especially one who might want to join you in tasting all that life has to offer, even if it means being the designated driver on your tour of the dive bars of Reading, Pennsylvania. Thank you, dear. Ladies and gentlemen, please let him know that in Philadelphia, we will never have quite enough of Mr. Calvin Trillin.
Thank you. Yeah, I was a little disappointed you didn't work the word dashing in there, but I told Ed not to be worried about being too effusive. Can you hear me now? Occasionally, when somebody wants to give a very long introduction, I say, just keep it really simple. Something like, not since Mark Twain. So I'm very pleased to be back at the Free Library of Philadelphia. Authors are pathetically grateful to libraries. In bookstores, as you know, the average shelf life of a book in America is somewhere between milk and yogurt. Books by people like Danielle Steele and Dan Brown have a longer shelf life, but they contain preservatives. I've been connected for a long time with the New York Public Library. Originally, when they had something called tables of contents dinners, where people, you would sign up from a kind of a brochure of an invitation, which dinner you wanted to go to for, I can't remember how much money it was. And of course, this being New York, a lot of the dinners were quite lavish, and the descriptions were paragraphs long about an evening in the court of Louis the 14th with chef flown in from Paris and the historian from Columbia to explain everything, and they asked us if we could do one, and I said, well, we could do one called Pretty Decent Chinese Takeout. And they said, what would be the description? I said, no eating directly from cartons permitted. Of course, great works of literature don't have to depend on libraries. People keep them. I was at a speaker at the an Authors Guild Gala a few years ago where we were asked to write rejection letters to famous works of literature. Garrison Keillor, who organized the evening, rejected Walden Pond. He said there are a lot of good axioms, but the structure was weak, and he suggested making it into a calendar. I rejected The Wasteland by T.S. Eliot. The last couplet was, "I know this is a blow, Tom, not to worry. You're still the greatest poet from Missouri." It's easy to be, of course, from the other poet from Missouri is me. We're sort of the Missouri school of poetry, T.S. Eliot and I, and we have some similarities. We both were from different parts of Missouri, I should say. He was from St. Louis, which after they built the arch, started calling itself the Gateway to the West. And I'm from Kansas City, the former Gateway to the West, where we think of St. Louis as the exit from the East. We both use a little German. He's famous for using German. I remember rhyming Alberto Gonzalez with Loyal Uber Alles. Otherwise, we vary a bit on language. He uses a lot of Sanskrit, and I'm not big on Sanskrit. I was one of those kids who really paid attention in Sanskrit class in Kansas City. I use Yiddish sometimes. Eliot, I think it's fair to say, was not partial to Yiddish. For instance, when the breakup of Yugoslavia came, I wrote a poem that went, "Croatians are the good guys now, although their past is somewhat shady. So worry not that these same guys chased both your bubby and your Zadie." I'm a second-generation poet. I don't know about Eliot. But my father, who was a grocer for most of his working life, had a restaurant at one point, and he used it to write a rhyming couplet on the lunch menu every day, mostly about pie. He rhymed pie with "evening is nigh" and "all right, warden, I'm ready to fry. I've had my last piece of Mrs. Trillin's pie." And he believed the pie was slimming. Said, "So you love the sound of soft lowing cattle, eat more pie and you'll be lighter in the saddle." His shortest poem was "Don't Sigh, Eat Pie." I wrote a much shorter poem than that that's actually in the book. It doesn't take up much space. And it was called something like "The Political, Societal, and Philosophical Implications of the O.J. Simpson Trial." The title doesn't count in the length. And it is, "O.J., oy vey." My father was very big on rhyme. He didn't care much about meter. My favorite of his poems was, "Eat your dinner, Mom said gently to her little son, Roddy. If you don't, I'll break every bone in your body. It's unusual. It's unusual to have restaurant proprietor poetry. When you think about types of poetry in America, there's only one occupational group that has poets, and that's cowboys, who are thought of as rather taciturn and laconic. But there are so many cowboy poets, I think there are more cowboy poets than there are cowboys now. I met one once, Baxter Black, who wrote a book called Croutons on a Cow Pie. He wrote a poem called The Veterinarian's Laundry, which I think a fair critic would sum up as not for the faint-hearted. But I always wondered why there weren't more occupational groups. I mean, there's no such thing as a washing machine repairman poet or a professor of comparative literature poet, for that matter. I like to think of hedge fund poets. They have kind of a slam read-off at the Regency on Park Avenue in the morning. The limos are kind of purring outside. And the poet gets up and said, he always bought the day before the rise. He always sold the day before the dive. We never knew the secret of his touch. And now we know he's doing 2 to 5. I think I'm also a second-generation humorist. When I put this book together, I thought about my dad was pretty funny. I just can't imagine Eliot's dad being very funny. Maybe he was, in a very dry way. My father, for instance, instead of collecting stamps or something like that, he collected curses. He loved curses. He liked Irish curses. He loved those Yiddish curses like may you have an itch or it is impossible to scratch, another thing. Actually, Yiddish is the language of contention in New York, and I suggested at one point that instead of having a Spanish-English dictionary or something, they have a Yiddish-English dictionary for visitors. Except instead of phrases like, where's the nearest post office, you have things like, may streetcars grow on the back of your throat. And, my father's favorite curse was collected in South Miami Beach, before South Miami Beach became hip, and it was full of retired people from New York on limited incomes. And he heard a woman say to a butcher, may you have an injury that is not covered by workman's compensation. People sometimes say to me when they hear what I do for a living, aren't you ashamed of yourself for making a living by making snide, underhanded remarks about respectable people? And my only defense is it's not much of a living. The first magazine I submitted humor to was called Monocle, a magazine of political satire. They were not good payers. I sent them one piece, and they sent me a bill for the piece. And then the editor of Monocle became the editor of The Nation. Somebody I usually refer to as the wily and parsimonious Victor S. Navasky. And he asked me to do a column every 3 weeks. And I said, what were you thinking of paying for each column? And he said, oh, something in the high 2 figures. So what do you mean the high 2 figures? And he said, we've been paying 65. And I think it sounds like the middle 2 figures to me. So I called my high-powered literary agent, Robert Slowly Lesher, and I said, play hardball, Slowly. And Slowly got him up to 100. A few weeks after I started, he came to me and he said, what about these quotes? I said, what quotes are you talking about? He said, did John Foster Dulles really say, you can't fool all the people all the time, but you might as well give it your best shot? I said, Victor, at these rates, you can't expect real quotes. And then when I started to write what we later began calling deadline poetry, I was actually inspired by John Sununu. I think I'm probably the only person inspired to poetry by John Sununu. But if you'll remember, this is the original John Sununu, not his son, who became a senator later. The chief of staff is George H.W. Bush's administration, which was full of these people I called the nice white Protestant gentlemen in suits. They all looked alike, and it was very boring. There weren't even any juicy indictments. And the only person who stood out was Sununu, who wasn't even shaped like the others. And he also had that wonderful quality that we all look for, those of us in the small joke trade, is he was very intent on proving he was the smartest guy in the room. Ed Rollins, the Republican political strategist, said that Sununu was a good argument for not telling your child that he has a high IQ. And also, he had that beautiful name, Sununu. It's the most euphonious. I just love that name, and I used to think about it a lot. On the subway, particularly, there's a little Sununu. And finally, I wrote a poem called If You Knew What Sununu. I sent it to Victor S. Novasky, the wily and parsimonious one, and he wanted me to do one every week. Well, not every week, because The Nation only publishes every other week in the summer, even though the downtrodden are oppressed every day of the year. But every issue. And I said, how much do you think of paying me? And he said, $100, the same as you used to get for the column. By that time, the column was in syndication. So I thought, well, it doesn't sound like a lot of money. But then I checked into how poets are paid in the United States, and they're ordinarily paid by the line. And at that time, the New Yorker was the highest-paying magazine, $10 a line. If you do the math, you can see why there's not a huge crowd in front of the poetry booth at the Career Day Fair. But I was getting $100 for a poem. So if I wrote, say, a four-line poem, I was the highest-paid poet in the United States. I wrote one, for instance, in the last campaign about Mitt Romney. Yes, Mitt's so smooth of speech and slick of garb, he reminds us all of Ken and Barbie. So quick to shed his moderate regalia, he may, like Ken, be lacking genitalia. When I really want to get that buzz you get for working at the absolute top dollar in your field, I write a two-line poem. I started early doing that when Lloyd Bentsen, the Texas senator, was named Secretary of the Treasury. I did a poem called History of Lloyd Bentsen's Dealings with Special Interest Groups. And it went, the man is known for quo pro quidness. In Texas, that's how folks do business. That's $50 a line. And when George W. Bush's college transcript was revealed during the 2000 Republican primary, to no observable effect on the campaign, I wrote a poem called Obliviously On He Sails with Marks Not Quite As Good As Quails. Writing deadline poetry, there's a section in the book that's called 20 Years of Paul's One Poem Each. And my problem with the people who become president is that they do not have very good names. I am for a completely open political system, except for people whose names aren't good for rhyme or meter. For instance, Clinton is a very bad name. It's the orange of American presidents. In the second term of his administration, during the unpleasantness, remember when Hillary Clinton was said to be taking the lead in his defense, went on the Today program and all that. I wanted to write a poem, but Clinton was not a good name. So I had to use what we used to call her maiden name. We don't use that term anymore, I don't think. Or name of origin, or slave name, something. And the poem was, "And so it's up to our Ms. Rodham to prove Bill's White House isn't Sodom. It's left to this adroit senora to show that it is just Gomorrah." My candidates don't win. My candidates are iambic candidates. Ross Perot, John McCain. Although I did like Robert Dole because he rhymes with Old King Cole, sauteed escargot, practically anything you want. Obama's not a good name because I used up all the rhymes, as Ed proved, with Osama. Yokohama, slap your mama. It's an old Louisiana phrase. You taste my etouffee, you'll go home and slap your mama. And Bush is not a good rhyme. It rhymes with tush, but that's disrespectful. I never use that. Fortunately, when George H.W. Bush retired and I wanted to write a poem, I realized he had a lot of middle names, so I use those. That poem was, "Farewell to you, George Herbert Walker. Though never treasured as a talker, your predicates were always prone to wander nounless off alone. You did your best in your own way, the way of Greenwich Country Day. So just relax and take your ease. And never order Japanese." I'm sometimes asked if politicians get mad about what I write, and they don't. If they're mad, or if they read it, they didn't say. But I have had sort of a recurring nightmare, which started about 10 or 15 years ago, where I go to a dinner party in New York, and they're all there. Because ordinarily I don't meet them because I live in New York and they live in Washington. In this nightmare, I arrive early because I find a great parking spot. As you heard, I'm the author of Tepper Isn't Going Out, which, and I'm not here to boast, we believe is the first parking novel. At any rate, I get to the party and I'm the first one there because of the parking spot. No, I'm the second one there. The host isn't even home from the office yet, but the hostess is there, and so is Steve Forbes. And he is wearing that maniacal grin that he has, and the hostess said, "I have to do something in the kitchen, and you two must have a lot to talk about." There's an uneasy silence. And finally, I say, "I suppose you're wondering why I kept referring to you during the campaign as a dork robot. But before he can answer, Al Gore comes across the room. He's in Earth Colors, and he's quite irritated and gives a long wooden lecture about why I shouldn't have referred to him in a poem as a manlike object. Then here comes Robert Torricelli, the first senator, who's quite angry because I suggested as a campaign slogan for him, never been indicted. And Al D'Amato is there. And he is quite mad, and he uses bad language, Al D'Amato. And he's very angry with me. And I say, it's also just a matter of rhyme, Senator. People say, it's a hard rhyme, D'Amato. And people say you could rhyme it with tomato, but I'm from Kansas City. I can't bring myself to say tomato. It does happen to rhyme with sleazeball obligato. And then Henry Kissinger is approaching. And I said, Henry Kissinger, is he still mad about that one little war criminal mention? Talk about hypersensitive. But that's not what he's mad about. What he's mad about is that I wondered in some column why George Shultz, a former Secretary of State with a PhD, is always referred to as Mr. Shultz, and Henry Kissinger, a former Secretary of State with a PhD, is always referred to as Dr. Kissinger. And the only thing I could figure is that maybe Kissinger has a podiatry practice on the side. I tell you the people who do write and get angry, and that's the animal people. And by animal people, I do not mean people who were thrown clear in a plane crash in Africa when they were babies and were raised by a pack of hyenas. Not those kind of animal people. I mean people with a special concern for animals, an admirable concern for animals. I live in Canada, in Nova Scotia, in the summer, and I listen a lot to the CBC. You can learn a lot. They give you a lot to think about at the CBC, particularly about animals. I heard a program once that said, hummingbird weighs as much as a quarter. And what I thought was, well, does it weigh as much as two dimes and a nickel there? And my daughters were a little concerned about how you'd go about weighing a hummingbird, because they're flitting around everywhere. And I try to put their mind at ease. And I said, we've all seen those nature documentaries where they shoot a stun dart into a wildebeest. It's the same thing. It's so the hard part's not even hitting it with that little bitty dart. The hard part's slapping it on the face to bring it around. I got a lot of letters accusing me of telling people to slap hummingbirds. Also, I wrote a column about the chicken you play tic-tac-toe with in Chinatown. I used to take people, I still take people on walks to Chinatown, out-of-town people, and sometimes my daughters. And when there's an out-of-town guest, I used to walk to Chinatown and then give the guests the opportunity to play tic-tac-toe with a chicken. There's a live chicken in a Chinese amusement arcade, it was called. And it was in one of those glass cases with backlit lighting, letters on it, bird's turn, your turn, where to push the button. And I had heard that the chicken had been trained by former graduate students of B.F. Skinner, which turned out to be true. I later did a piece about it, and I was happy it was true because I think it's a refutation of the false teaching that graduate work is of no use in the everyday world. But I would take these people down to Chinatown to play the chicken. And if you beat the chicken, it only cost 50 cents to play. And I put up 50 cents. I was the host. And if you beat the chicken, you got a very large bag of fortune cookies, which worth at least 35, 40 cents probably. And so I took people down there, and they all said the same thing when they first looked over the situation. They said, "But the chicken gets to go first." I said, "But he's a chicken." You're a human being. Surely there should be some advantage. And then many of them, not all of them, but many of them, I'm embarrassed how many, said, "The chicken plays every day." Well, eventually the chicken died and it couldn't be replaced because the animal people said it was demeaning to the chicken. I said, "Demeaning? I've never seen a chicken lose. Chicken's probably stinky with self-esteem." Well, some of those stories are in the book. And some personal stories. Story about my collie dog, Chubby. This is a story about worrying about trying to write memoir in the United States when it's kind of an atrocity arms race in memoir. You have to reveal some hideous secret in your family, like incest at least, or bestiality, or incestuous bestiality, or... And I wouldn't want this to get back to New York, but I think it's safe to say here, I had a happy childhood. So I imagined myself in a sort of memoirist hangout, and they were changing these stories about glue-sniffing grandmothers and things and the family tapeworm. And they look over to me, and I say, "A true story." I said, "Well, there's my collie dog, Chubby. And this really happened. I was about 3 or 4. My sister, Suki, the oppressor, about a year and a half older. And we had a little collie puppy named Chubby. He was quite sickly. And one day he disappeared. And we said to our parents, 'Where's Chubby?' And they said, 'We gave Chubby to some friends who have a farm. He'll be able to frolic in the barnyard in the sunlight with the other animals. He'll be happy.' I didn't think about it much. And then some years later, Chubby's name came up. I was home from college. We were all having dinner together, and Chubby's name came up, and I said, 'Why don't we ever go visit Chubby at the farm?' And my sister said, 'There wasn't any farm, you dummy. Chubby had to be put down.' I said, 'Chubby's gone?' And my mother said, 'Chubby'd probably be gone in any case, because collies didn't usually live 18 to 20 years. And I said, yeah, but why am I just finding out now? And my father said, 'It's not our fault you're slow on the uptake.' So I put this in a magazine piece or a book or something, and about a week later, I got a call from Suki, my sister. She said the collie dog was not called Chubby. Collie dog was called George. You were called Chubby. Thank you.
So I almost hate to bother to go to Q&A. I mean, unless you've got something that'll prompt a funny response, please raise your hand and we'll get a mic to you. Right here in front.
There was a memoir about a father. I was taken with the stories of your father that I'm sure you read. It was such a quick read. Blank, my father said. Do you want me to spell it?
Blank, and I can spell blank, B-L-A-N-K.
It was S-H blank T.
Oh.
My father said.
Don't say that out loud.
I know. And that was, I thought, a pretty funny story about a father who had a whole lifetime of interesting things that his son talked about. I'm wondering if you had any reaction to it and if you ever considered writing a book about your dad's aphorisms.
I don't know that book, so no, I never heard of it. It may be because I led a protected life. And my father didn't say that because my father did not curse. The strongest thing I ever heard him say when he was exasperated, which he occasionally was with me, was "for crying out loud." And for years, I thought that was what grown-ups said when they were absolutely at the end of their tether. He also didn't drink, and he didn't smoke, and he didn't drink coffee. I'm not sure why he didn't drink coffee. But one time he was a very stubborn man, and one time I was home. But I think when I was a reporter in the South, and I was having a cup of coffee with my mother in the kitchen, and she said, "Would you like cream in your coffee?" And I said, "No, I don't use cream." And my father said, "Well, I tell you one thing," and he often started, "you couldn't tell the difference between coffee with cream and coffee without cream." And I said, "Perhaps, since you've never tasted coffee in your life, you may not be the expert on that." And he said, "I don't care what you say." That was one of his phrases, "I don't care what you say." He also said it stands to reason a lot. I mean, for instance, he thought that you couldn't gain any more from eating something than what it weighed. Stands to reason, he always said. And the only advice I can ever remember getting from him was he had a phrase, "You might as well be a mensch." A mensch is like upright human being, a person who stands up for his friends and leaves a borrowed apartment in the same way he found it. And I like that phrase because it implied that he had thought of the alternatives, really, and it was sort of casual. When I wrote the book about my father, I said that people's childhoods, if you listen to them talk about their childhood, there was often a theme emerging, like, "We come from a distinguished family, you must never do anything to besmirch its name," or "We're miserable because your father deserted us," or some kind of a theme. And then I thought, what would I want the theme of my girl's childhood to be? They grew up in Greenwich Village. And I thought the theme I would like for their childhood was, "Despite all evidence to the contrary, you're being raised in Kansas City." Well, one of my daughters has a boss who was from the Midwest, and she said she grew up under a two-step program. Get over it and stay over it. Are there other questions?
Gentleman about five rows.
Having spent a long amount of time in the Midwest, I'm very grateful for your advice about how to find a good restaurant in a small town. I'm recently arrived in Philadelphia, and I'm just wondering if you have any advice about how to find a good restaurant in Philadelphia.
Well, I would ask some of these people, for instance, who, you could use the same method I used in strange towns, which is that if I couldn't find a restaurant any other way, I would walk over to the motel desk as if I was going to ask the checkout time or something. Grab the guy by the necktie and pull him over the desk to get his attention and say, not the place you took your parents for their 25th wedding anniversary, the place you went to the night you got home after 13 months in Korea. And the second place is in almost any city in the United States, I'm sure Philadelphia too, is quite good. The first place is the restaurant that I used to call La Maison de la Casa House, Continental Cuisine, where the Continental has to do with Antarctica, where everything starts out frozen, or maybe the Continental Trailway Bus Company.
Another question? Gentleman, dead center there, if you would keep your hand up, sir.
Could you tell us one of your more memorable visits to the Johnny Carson show?
Oh, well, I liked going on the Johnny Carson show, partly because he was so good at it. He never said anything that wasn't in some way interrogatory. I mean, he always left the ball to hit back, and he was very good at embellishing a joke without taking the joke away. He was very confident. He knew it was his show. And we sort of talked in the same rhythm. I think he's from Nebraska, and I think... and also, he could do little things, little skillful things, like once I was talking about, during the Reagan administration, and once I was talking about how, in the way that the Johnson administration became dominated by Vietnam, the Reagan administration might become dominated by plastic surgery. And and I said, I even heard that when the Vice President, George H.W. Bush, had his annual checkup at Walter Reed, he said to the doctor, could you do something to make me look a little less preppy around the eyes? And I sort of swallowed the word preppy. And he somehow repeated it and got it out without sounding like he was emphasizing it. He was just very skillful. I only had one opportunity to book somebody on the show. I used to go with my uncle, who used to be the city librarian of Salina, eventually ended up at UCLA, and was retired. And he used to come to the show sometime. And then he and I and what was called the talent coordinator, the guy who booked me, would go to this sort of gringo Mexican restaurant across the street, and then the car would take me to the Red Eye. And he said one night, the booker, Johnny would like more civilians on the show. That was their word for people not in show business. He had a chicken plucker on, and he thought it was so good. And he said, I don't suppose you know anybody. And I said, well, I know a fantastic smoke ring blower. He is the best smoke ring blower you've ever seen. And the booker said, what does he do for a living? And I said, He's a player piano salesman and a harpsichord restorer for a living. And they always say, what's his name? What's his name? So I called him the name. And I said, but he's a horrible person. He filled our living room with cigar smoke. My wife hates him. And he's very pompous. He's sort of like the guy in the Chaplin movies who slips on a banana peel. He said, just give me his name, his number. So about 2 days later, he called me and he said, watch Friday. I said, you're kidding. I said, they're starlets who would do unspeakable things to get on this show. And they do unspeakable things, and they still don't get on the show. And you book this guy? And he said, yeah. I said, how do you know he's in? He said, I know. I could tell on the phone. He said, watch Friday. And I was busy, and I totally forgot to watch Friday. And the next day, I was having lunch with a friend in the village, and he said, did you happen to see Carson last night? And I said, no. And he said, it's the weirdest thing. He said, someone was trying to blow smoke rings. I said, did you say trying? Apparently, they hadn't considered the ventilation system. And he went right on with his act. He would say, one smoke ring inside another smoke ring. Smoke. Just smoke. Here's one for you, Johnny. Smoke. So I called the booker and I said, well, I told you he wasn't much of a smoke ring blower. Charming guy in his own way. And he said, are you kidding? He's going to be on the bus of Carson for sure. And he was. Johnny just sat there like that and watched him. So I managed to book one act on the show.
Inspiring. All the way in back in the middle, and then there's somebody also on this side all the way in back. Folks, could you keep your hands up so we can get the mic to you? Just speak into it.
Okay. Many years ago, you wrote a wonderful piece in The New Yorker about the grandparent gap. I'm wondering if you could bring us up to date on whether or not that's been filled.
That has been filled, I'm happy to say. I have two daughters, and one has two little boys, and one has two little girls. The one with the two little boys, in fact, lives in Hunterdon County, New Jersey, not far from here. And the other one I'm going to see tomorrow. She lives in San Francisco. And being a grandfather is, as some of you know, a great delight. And it's fun to see your own children as parents, for one thing. And one of my grandsons is a picky eater, and his mother was a picky eater. And when she says something like, just try it, I say, revenge is sweet. Also, I have found myself, as a grandparent, I have found myself in fancy children's clothing stores uttering a phrase, perhaps not in these precise words, but the burden is the same, uttering a phrase I thought I would never say, which is, don't you have anything more expensive than this? It's filled.
One last question in back here.
I just want to say first, thank you for all the wonderful writing. And also, when you mentioned the word orange is sort of a benchmark for difficult rhymes, it reminded me that I had seen Eminem do the same thing about 8 months ago, I think on 60 Minutes, and I was wondering if you noticed any other parallels between the two of your works.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.